there. Welcome back to Books with Bert. I'm continuing again this week with a chapter from my book, The Myth of the Robber Barons. This chapter is on the Scrantons and the making of America's first iron rails. The iron and steel industry was critical for the rise of the United States to becoming the world's premier economic power in the 1800s. With iron and steel, America could mass produce rails and use them to cut transportation costs, open markets out west, and speed new products to cities throughout the nation. In the world of the 1800s, if a nation could produce cheap iron and steel, it could shape its own destiny. The problem for America was that Englishmen controlled the world's iron markets and controlled them completely. They had developed the first blast furnaces, and they also invented the puddling techniques needed to purify molten iron. They likewise had a generation of skilled iron makers eager to compete on a world market. In short, they had a head start, and during the 1830s, they used that head start to build all of America's iron rails. They also sent to America iron-tipped plows, locks, nails, and all of the cast iron pipes used for our nation's water system. By 1840, dozens of Americans were frantically tinkering with different types of fuels, ores, blast furnaces, trying to produce American-made iron. In 1839, Nicholas Biddle, the former president of the Bank of the United States, lamented, quote, "With all of the materials for supplying iron in our own lands, the country has been obliged to pay enormous sums to Europeans. This dependence is horrible," end quote. Rails were especially needed, and 6 years later, the magazine, the American Railroad Journal, complained, quote, "The American iron masters appear to consider railroad iron as unworthy of their notice. Not a bar of T-rail has yet been rolled in the three great anthracite and iron districts of Pennsylvania." During the 1840s, Pennsylvania's Lackawanna Valley, in the northeast part of the state, would be the battleground where American independence from English iron would be fought and won. This masterpiece of entrepreneurship was largely the work of two brothers, George and Selden Scranton, and their first cousin, Joseph Scranton, who, after much experimenting, became the first Americans to mass-produce rails. In doing so, they harnessed talent, capital, and technical expertise from within their families and friends, investors in small towns in the Lackawanna Valley, and even outsiders in New York. Two things are striking. First, the Lackawanna Valley, with its thinly scattered, low-quality ore deposits, was not a natural setting for manufacturing. Second, in the competition for urban growth, the city of Scranton did not exist until the 1840s. Nearby Wilkes-Barre and Carbondale had the advantages of age and wealth. The migration of the visionary Scrantons to northeast Pennsylvania began in 1839 when William Henry, a trained geologist, scoured the area looking for the right ingredients for iron making. Those included water power, anthracite coal, iron ore, lime, and sulfur. He found these elements near Wilkes-Barre, the largest, oldest, and wealthiest city in northeast Pennsylvania. Wilkes-Barre's leaders, though, were cautious. They preferred to ship coal safely down the Susquehanna River, not to risk their fortunes on unproven iron. They rejected Henry's efforts to start an iron company in Wilkes-Barre. So Mr. Henry went 20 miles east into the wilderness of the Lackawanna Valley and looked over the land there. It had some water power and, of course, lots of anthracite. He also found small quantities of iron ore and lime, so he wrongly assumed that iron would be plentiful. It wasn't. Playing a hunch, though, Henry took an option to buy 500 acres of land at present-day Scranton and build a blast furnace on it. He sought the necessary $20,000, which would be more like $600,000 today, for the scheme from his family, specifically his son-in-law, Selden Scranton, and Scranton's brother George, both of whom were operating an ironworks in New Jersey. Also helpful was their first cousin, Joseph Scranton, his brother-in-law, Joseph Platt, and friends Sanford Grant and John and James Blair, who were merchants and bankers in Belvedere, New Jersey. These entrepreneurs, whom we will call the Scranton Group, raised the $20,000 in 1840 and spent the next 2 years building the blast furnace and digging the ore and coal to make iron. Making iron, they quickly discovered, required more entrepreneurship than they had originally expected. The local ores and limestone were limited and of poor quality. They had chosen the wrong location, but it was too late to sell out and switch, so they searched eastern Pennsylvania and New Jersey for the right combination of ores and limestone. As the magazine The Iron Manufacturer's Guide later understated, quote, "The absence of anthracite iron deposits was a bitter disappointment to the first manufacturers of iron with anthracite coal. Only the local coal lived up to expectations. But this was available in other areas with established cities closer to the lime and ore. When the Scrantons made their iron, they had to import lime and ore on boats from Danville, Pennsylvania, about 30 miles up the Susquehanna River, right by the city of Wilkes-Barre, and then over 20 miles of land to Scranton. The high costs of transportation and the unexpected purchases of ore and lime almost ran the Scrantons into bankruptcy. Then George Scranton came up with a plan to convert the iron into nails. Such a bold venture into manufacturing would not be cheap. The need for a rolling mill and a nail factory upped the ante to $86,000, which would be well over $1 million today. Desperate for credit, George Scranton coaxed some of his money from the New Yorkers. Yet this jeopardized the family's ownership, so he placed his greatest reliance on other members of the Scranton Group. Longtime friends John and James Blair invested money from their bank in New Jersey. Joseph Scranton sent funds from his business in Augusta, Georgia. By 1843, George Scranton had his $86,000. He had kept control within the family, and he began making nails for markets throughout the East Coast. The nail factory failed miserably. First, no rivers or rails helped market its product. Second, the Scranton nails were very poor in quality. The low-grade ores in the Lackawanna Valley provided only brittle and easily breakable nails. Faced with bankruptcy, the Scrantons contemplated the conversion of the nail mill into a rolling mill for railroad tracks. Now, experienced Englishmen still dominated the world production of rails in the 1840s. No American firm had dared to challenge them. After floundering in the production of nails, however, the Scrantons desperately searched for a rail contract to restore their lost investment. As luck would have it, in 1846, the Erie Railroad had a contract with the state of New York to build a rail line 130 miles from the New York City area to Binghamton, New York. When Englishmen hesitated to supply the Erie with the needed rails, the Scrantons had their chance. They traveled to New York and boldly persuaded the board of directors of the Erie Railroad to give their newly formed company a 2-year contract for producing 12,000 tons of rails. They promised to supply rails cheaper and quicker than the British. Impressed with the Scrantons and desperate for rails, the directors of the Erie Railroad advanced $90,000 to the eager Scrantons to construct a rolling mill and to furnish the necessary track. The construction of the mill and the making of thousands of tons of rails seemed impossible. The contract called for the Scrantons to supply the Erie with rails in less than 20 months. The Scrantons would first have to learn how to make the rails they promised to provide. Building the blast furnaces would come next. Then they would have to import some ore and much limestone into the Lackawanna Valley to make the rails. Finally, because they lacked a water route to the Erie rail line, they would have to draft dozens of teams of horses to carry finished rails from the rolling mills scores of miles through the wilderness and up the mountains to New York, right where the track was to be laid. No wonder the New Yorkers wanted to back out at the last moment. Yet somehow, in less than a year and a half, the Scrantons did it. On December 27th, 1848, just 4 days before the expiration of the Erie's charter, the Scrantons fulfilled their contract and completed the rail line. Many Americans were amazed that an ironworks, located in the middle of a wilderness, with no connecting links to outside markets, could build and deliver 130 miles of rails to a railroad in another state. The Scrantons did not want to have to duplicate this feat, so they did two things. They started building a city around their ironworks, and then they began building a railroad to connect their city to outside markets. That way they could ship rails anywhere in the country and also export the local anthracite, which could then be sold as a home heating fuel. With backing from New York investors, the Scrantons completed the Delaware, Lackawanna, and Western Railroad, which went east toward New York City and north into New York to connect with the Erie Railroad. Building this railroad was no cinch. Some of the terrain was mountainous. Even after using gunpowder to level the hills, the grade was still steep. Also, George Scranton had to negotiate some delicate right-of-way problems with farmers along the rail route. They were over-evaluating their land. Of course, the Scrantons were using their own homemade rails for the new rail line, but this still ran into costs. For all of this, the Scrantons needed more New York capital, but they had to be careful. They wanted to be entrepreneurs, not pawns of the New Yorkers. The Scrantons had to make sure they retained a guiding interest in their projects. This they did, and George Scranton was the first president of the Delaware, Lackawanna, and Western Railroad. In 1853, flushed with success, the Scrantons also incorporated their ironworks as the Lackawanna Iron and Coal Company. They elected Selden Scranton as president. The building of America's premier ironworks and railroad was an amazing feat of collective entrepreneurship. The Scranton group became unified behind a vision of mass-produced rails, the creating of a city, and the laying of rails from its borders east and north to outside markets. As individuals, the members of the Scranton group had few of the skills and little of the capital needed to fulfill this vision, but collectively they did. They had to have outside cash, but their confidence and unity of purpose impressed New York investors and convinced them the Scrantons could do the job. All of this creates the impression that once the ironworks and the railroad were established, and once the city of Scranton was incorporated, the Scranton group had it made. But this was not the case. In fact, most of the Scranton group did not die rich, and two died very poor. William Henry, the original leader of the group, left the city in the 1840s after some bad investments. He died embittered and impoverished in the 1870s. Sanford Grant, the first owner of the company store, wilted when faced with business competition and industrial risk. Selling his stock, he left for New Jersey, where he lived without ulcers or wealth until his death in the 1880s. Displaying greater fortitude than Grant, Selden Scranton became the first president of the Lackawanna Company. 5 years later, though, he and his brother Charles left to operate a blast furnace in New Jersey. Their iron-making talents ultimately failed them. Selden declared bankruptcy in 1884 and died shortly thereafter. George Scranton, the early leader and the driving force behind coal and railroad development, had more faith and perseverance than most of the others. He amassed $200,000, which would be $4 million today. He built a fine mansion, and he served as the U.S. Congressman from northeastern Pennsylvania. George Scranton, however, still lost some of his fortune during the Panic of 1857 and had to sell much of his stock in the Lackawanna Railroad at reduced value. Plagued with health problems from overwork and the rugged days of the 1840s, George Scranton died in 1861 at age 49. Three other members of the Scranton Group never abandoned their vision of manufacturing rails and building a city. They achieved fabulous success and wealth. On top was Joseph Scranton, who said right from the start, quote, "I have no fears of the ultimate success of the ironworks. I have invested in it, should remain in it until my fortune has doubled or been lost, as the case may be." 27 years later, Scranton was president of the flourishing Lackawanna Iron and Coal Company. He was worth $1.1 million, which is $22 million in today's currency. That made him the wealthiest man in northeast Pennsylvania. His brother-in-law and next-door neighbor, Joseph Platt, was superintendent of the Lackawanna Iron and Coal Company and was worth $220,000, which would be around $5 million today. Right behind Joseph Scranton with $910,000, almost $20 million today, was his friend James Blair, who had backed the Scrantons from nails to rails. Blair held lots of stock in both the ironworks and the railroad. He then expanded and started Scranton's first trolley company. Some people point to such wealth and the absence of it in other households and argue that the state should redistribute it or at least tax it at high rates. It hardly seems fair, they might say, that some people should have so little while three men, Joseph Scranton, Joseph Platt, and James Blair, should own close to 10% of all the wealth in the city of Scranton. What we need, according to this view, is an active state to transfer income, chop up inheritances, perhaps even to impose equality of condition. To argue this way, however, is to miss a key point. Scranton's founders, as entrepreneurs, created something out of nothing. They created their assets and created opportunities for others when they successfully bore the risks of making America's first iron rails. Without them, almost everybody else in the region would have been poorer. The amount of wealth in a region, or a country for that matter, is not fixed. In 1870, Scranton, Platt, and Blair got the biggest piece of the economic pie, but it was the biggest piece of a much larger pie, made so by what they cooked up when they came to Pennsylvania 30 years earlier. When they came to the Lackawanna Valley, it was a poor farming region with no close ties to outside markets. In 1850, according to the federal census, no one in the Lackawanna Valley was worth more than $10,000. In 1870, after the Scrantons had established their city and their ironworks, 33 families in Scranton were worth at least $100,000. That's $2 million today. One of these people was already a millionaire. Thousands of other families were working their way toward better lives. The Scrantons' ironworks and railroad were the means to this end. Now, some people look at the results of splendid entrepreneurship and say, well, somebody else might have come along later and done the same thing. We can see how improbable this is in the Scranton case. The wealthy leaders in the older, more prosperous city of Wilkes-Barre, for example, shunned manufacturing for years and often tried to thwart the Scranton's plans. If the Scranton's had not come along, England might have continued to dominate the rail markets of the world for many more decades. To be sure, the anthracite in the Lackawanna Valley was already attracting New York investors, but they came only to get coal, not to build cities and make the region prosper. Without dedicated local entrepreneurs, the Lackawanna Valley of northeast Pennsylvania, like so many mining regions, would have enjoyed only fleeting and limited prosperity. The entrepreneurs in New York would have bought the coal land cheap, then supplied transportation to the region, collected the profits, and left Northeast Pennsylvania full of deserted mines and ghost towns. Let's look at the different opportunities the Scrantons, as entrepreneurs, created intentionally and unintentionally for others. First, the people in Northeast Pennsylvania, especially those with capital to invest, now had new and better opportunities available. Investors from county seats near Scranton set up Scranton's first two banks, the first large flour mill, a locomotive factory, a stove-making factory, and a large coal mining company. Another group of winners were the many local farmers who held onto their land and sold it later as coal land. All they had to do was watch others do the work of establishing the region's export. After this, they cashed in. The Scrantons bore the risks of making rails from imported ore. Then they risked building a railroad to connect the Lackawanna region to New York City. All the farmers had to do was hold on to their land and watch it rise in value, from $15 an acre in 1840 to $800 an acre in 1857. In just 17 years then, a 160-acre farm increased in worth from $2,400 to $128,000. That's many millions of dollars in today's money. Some of these locals ended up richer than the wealthiest of the Scrantons. Benjamin Troop, for example, was a local physician who watched the Scrantons build their ironworks. Then he bought up much of the land in the area on the chance that they might succeed. He later wrote a book describing his real estate exploits and expressing his gratitude to the Scrantons. He even named his only son after George Scranton. When Troop died in 1897, he left an estate of $10 million. That's $200 million in money today. Troop had become wealthier than any of the Scrantons. Even immigrants could get rich in Scranton. The growth of Scranton from a farming hamlet in 1840 to 45,000 people in 1880 brought thousands of immigrants to town. Many of them worked in the factories and improved their lives. They saved a little money, bought their own homes. Some of them had the talent and vision to rise to the top. In 1880, of Scranton's 40 most prominent businessmen, measured by memberships on board of directors, 9 of those 40 were immigrants. Some of these rags-to-riches immigrants were clearly among the most successful men in Scranton. Thomas Dixon, for example, came to America from Scotland. He began work as a mule driver. Soon he began making engines, boilers, and locomotives for the Scrantons. He ended up as president of the Delaware and Hudson Railroad, a 500-mile line that linked Scranton to outlets all over the East. Another immigrant, John German, came to Scranton in 1847 from England and began working for the Scrantons for 75 cents a day. With his limited cash and credit, he leased some abandoned mines northeast of Scranton. Defying the skeptics, Mr. German bought new machines and fulfilled a contract for 1 million tons of coal. He then tripled his contract and was on his way to becoming the largest independent coal operator in the Lackawanna region. A local credit agent said that German was, quote, believed to be unaffected by the times, holding his own versus all contingencies. When Mr. German died in 1902, he left an estate of $7 million, which is equivalent to $140 million in today's wealth. Because the Scrantons did what they did, thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, and even millions of Americans had new opportunities in life. Well, what does the story of the Scrantons tell us? First, we should be astonished and in awe as we watch free markets in action in the United States. Iron and steel were the keys to greatness in the world of the 1800s. Without steel, no country would have the economic and military power to create prosperity for its citizens. Great Britain was the world's top producer of steel and also the leading economic and military power in the world in the 1800s. Until the Scranton Group came along in the 1840s, the U.S. lagged way behind. With no competitive iron and steel industry, the U.S. had to import rails from Britain. So, where did the lowly Scrantons decide to build their blast furnaces to make iron and steel? New York City? Philadelphia? Or maybe Boston? No, in the wilderness of northeast Pennsylvania. There, the Scranton group had little money, limited resources, and no city to draw support. Yet they manufactured rails and delivered them safely and on time to the Erie Railroad. All of this benefited American independence, not political independence, which America won from Britain in the Revolutionary War, but this time economic independence, as the Scrantons built their iron and steel industry in the brand new city of Scranton. The success of the Scrantons surprised almost everyone in the United States. It was such a risky and uncertain enterprise. Some members of the Scranton group went bankrupt. Others grew very rich. The top three wealth holders owned about 10% of the wealth in the city. Some people look at such wealth and say it is not right that three families should own 10% of the wealth of the city of Scranton. Free markets, they say, favor the rich and leave some people poor. But let's look at this situation more honestly. Everybody in their region was poor before the Scrantons arrived. True, three members of the Scranton group grew rich through their hard work, talent, and luck, and willingness to take risks. They created new opportunities for almost all Americans. First, they created cheaper transportation of products on the Erie Railroad, which included all residents from New York to Ohio to Michigan. Second, the Scrantons created new incentives for others to go into iron and steel and expand the U.S. economy. And third, they opened doors for others to come to Scranton and start businesses as the population skyrocketed. If the U.S. had been a socialist country in the 1800s, a group of economic planners would have decided what industries to start and how to distribute the wealth from these industries. Would these planners have decided to take a chance on making iron and steel when England was so dominant? Probably not. But if they had, where would they have put the industry, and who would they have chosen to run it? Not the Scrantons, who were virtually unknown in the 1840s. In this hypothetical example, would the people the socialists put in charge of iron and steel have had the courage and determination to achieve what the Scrantons accomplished? That's very unlikely. What's more likely is the U.S., without daring entrepreneurship, would have remained a second-rate economic country until we exchanged central planning for freedom and turned loose those people in our country with the skill and determination to make steel more capably than the dominant steelmakers in Britain. This story of the Scrantons comes from a chapter of my book, The Myth of the Robber Barons. I wrote a separate book on the Scrantons, a book entitled Urban Capitalists, which I recommend. I also recommend Peter Temin's book, Iron and Steel in 19th Century America. And that concludes today's episode of Books with Bert. Thank you all for listening. Be sure to subscribe and rate my podcast. 5 stars if you like it, I hope. Rate it on Spotify, iTunes, or any other place where you can get podcasts so you don't miss future episodes. And if you like today's episode and you want to find more content to fill your heart with love for America and conservative ideas, be sure to check out YAF.org. The conservative movement starts here. Until next time, keep reading.